Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we've seen the cracks emerge in Babylon. We've seen the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you're already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is August 14, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us again for a continuation on Hitler's speeches leading up to the invasion of France. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And it's not so much an invasion of France as it is a necessary attack to contain an enemy. Since we showed in our last speech, I believe we adequately demonstrated that with the information we brought in and with what Hitler said, that Germany did not want a war with Poland, but Field Marshal Smigley said that whether or not Germany wants a war, Poland is going to give them a war, and war is unavoidable. So Germany really had no choice but to fight all these enemies. Otherwise, they would have had enemies on their borders for the next several years.
Well, there was going to be the Jews had decided in 1933 that there was going to be no Germany, right?
Exactly.
And the Jews had used all those ancient ethnic rivalries to agitate the Second World War. There's absolutely no doubt. Hitler had no choice. The French on one side, the Poles on the other. Stalin openly announced the Soviet intentions at world conquest. They were the ones that really wanted to take over the world, right? He wanted every European nation to be a Soviet republic and basically have a seat in the Supreme Council of Soviets, right? I mean, these plans are no secret. They're all over the place in speeches and writings and people just don't take the time to look at them.
And Judea may have declared war on Germany in March of 1933, but the British Daily Express, they don't have that newspaper available. For £50, they'll sell you the archive issue of the paper the day before and the day after, but the actual day of Judea declares war on Germany, that paper's not available for some reason. Their archive doesn't have it.
Well, right, absolutely.
I called them and asked them about that, and they said they couldn't help me.
Right, they don't want to. Right, they should know what they printed that day, and they don't. And that's because it exposes the international Jew for what he is. And Hitler told us all the time what he was in his speeches, and he'll tell us in this speech. He told us all the time exactly what was going on. He told us throughout Mein Kampf exactly what was happening.
And that's why the Jews vilify and demonize him, along with Jesus. The two most hated people in the world today by international Jewry are the two people who have taught the most against the Jews.
Well, right. But as we studied in this series, you go back to 1872 and read Wilhelm Marr, and he's warning about the victory of Judaism over Germanism, that Germany was basically infiltrated and usurped and its culture being turned over by Jews at that time. So Adolf Hitler, he's only demonized for seeing the handwriting on a wall and trying to do something about it.
A lot of people have raised the alarm against the Jews, but Hitler was somebody who actually did something substantial about it.
Well, right. He had his time and his place, and that's, you know, we should learn from his failures and use him as an example. But he was definitely fighting the fight that all white nationalist patriots today should be fighting.
And thinking about what he did, putting an end to Jewish pornography against white women, Jewish pimping and prostitution, Jewish dope peddling, Jewish pedophilia, kosher slaughter, putting an end to all of that. They consider that persecution, although we just consider it enforcing common decency and typical, normal, common sense standards.
Well, right. And the Jew worked in for 40 years in this country, 50 years, to do the same thing, to overturn all of our laws governing morality, to pollute our society with pornography and smut and filth, the same way they polluted Weimar Germany.
And if we finally put an end to that, or when we call for an end to it, they shout that we're oppressing them and we're trying to infringe their freedoms because they think that that means they're free to be a pervert.
Well, absolutely, because that's what the Jewish idea of freedom and liberty are. Liberty and freedom to be a pervert and a deviant.
All right, would you like to begin the speech?
The Jew is the producer of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Just like the Negro is the producer of Africa wherever he goes, wherever the Jew goes, the Canaanite Jew, you find Sodom and Gomorrah.
I think that was Robert E. Lee who said that wherever the white man goes, things are improving around him, and wherever the Negro goes, things are falling apart. So it seems that the ghetto is wherever you have enough Negroes in one area, and civilization is where you have a lot of white people congregated together.
Well, absolutely. We produce what our spirits govern us and allow us to produce, right? Well, January 30th, 1940, there's nothing, you know, significant, that there are no significant developments at this time. Russia's in the middle of the war with Finland, but we're in the phony war between England and Germany, which really wasn't a war. It wasn't a war of direct conflict. It was a war of blowing up each other's ships and U-boats, right?
Exactly. And I believe that if Hitler's speeches had been broadcast in English to the English audience, and maybe in French to the French audience, but who can say with the French, because they're largely degenerate, but if the English people had heard what he was saying and they weren't receiving brutally mistranslated, you know, quotes and excerpts from the Jewish press, they might have pushed for peace.
But, well, the Jewish media has led our people by the nose for nearly 200 years now. There's no doubt. And they've controlled the hearts and minds of the masses of the peoples of Europe and America for nearly 200 years through the media.
So, you know, Hitler says in German that he doesn't want a war with Britain, and the Jews translate it, today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world.
Yeah, right. They lie. And you know, I quoted several news sources in an article I had just wrote that the right foreign foe, FAUX, and I quoted news sources showing what the Jewish media in America was reporting concerning that this character in Norway that shot all these kids, right? I don't even want to give him the credibility of saying his name. Well, the Jews in America are reporting that he's an anti-Muslim, far-right-wing extremist. The Jews in Palestine are reporting that he's a fervent Zionist. So why is he anti-Muslim? Because he's a white nationalist? That's what the Western media is trying to portray him as, but it's a lie. He's anti-Muslim because he's a fervent Zionist, and the white people of Norway are quite liberal, and they support the Muslims in Palestine because they know that the Zionist Jews are basically oppressing them and mistreating them. And for that reason, this man shot a lot of white kids. But he's no nationalist. Nationalists don't shoot their own people.
And this guy condemned neo-Nazis. He condemned right-wingers. He's not any sort of Christian fundamentalist. He's a Christian Zionist like John Hagee.
Well, right, exactly. He's a Jew between the ears, and he may as well be a Jew. He's a shill for the Jews. He's a Shabbos goy, unless he really is a Jew. And the media is concealing that in America.
They're also concealing that he's a 32nd degree Mason and that his surname is typical of Norwegian Jews.
Right. And I wouldn't advocate we embrace the Muslims because the enemy of my enemy is not my friend. That's a Jewish ideal. Well, the media was doing the same thing with Germany all the time. The Jewish media lies constantly. If a Jew moves his lips, he's lying. And his media is used as a tool so that he can get what he wants done in the world. And the entire Western media has it's owned, 95% of it is owned and controlled by Jews, and it's promoted the desires of the Jews for over 100 years, and we're not going to get anything other than that out of it. We're certainly not going to get any truth out of it. It manipulates the nations in order to promote world Talmudism.
Absolutely. And at some point, Christians need to start reading gospel and taking it seriously, because I believe it's in the Epistle of John, one of the three, where he says, who is an antichrist? Who is a liar? But he who says that Jesus is not Messiah, that man is an antichrist.
Well, absolutely.
And every Jew denies that Jesus is Messiah, so every Jew is an antichrist and a liar.
Okay, January 30th, 1940. That the English and the Germans are bombing each other's shipping. The Germans managed to take out several British cargo steamers on this very day, and the Germans also managed to take out one of their own U-boats, mistaking it for an enemy submarine on this very day. That was
U-15. And one more thing that's noteworthy that happened in October of 1939, a U-boat, I think it was U-47 if I recall, penetrated Scapa Flow and torpedoed and sank the HMS Royal Oak, a British battleship. And, of course, Scapa Flow was supposed to be their most well-defended harbor, but you can see just how far Britain had fallen, being a Judaized degenerate power. You know, they didn't have the mastery of the seas that they once had. They couldn't even keep Scapa Flow safe.
Well, basically, Germany had a lot of victories, naval victories, that we don't hear a whole lot about. In World War II, even though they ultimately lost the war, if the United States didn't get involved in World War II, Germany would be ruling the Western world today in Europe, not in America, but in Europe. There's no doubt.
Exactly.
And actually, the German economy, though, was destroyed in two wars. It is still the most vibrant economy in Europe today. It's incredible. Northern Italy and Switzerland can compete, and some of the Scandinavian countries can compete to some degree, but the German economy is still the most vibrant and most productive economy in Europe.
Look at the other countries. France is a basket case. Greece is in perpetual anarchy.
And Britain's a lot worse off than the United States is today with a lack of manufacturing.
Absolutely, and I think Britain has more debt as a function of GDP than the U.S.
Probably. Okay, this is Adolf Hitler's speech in the Sports Palace in Berlin, January 30th, 1940. German Volks... I'm going to screw this up. Volksgenossen. 7 years are a short time indeed. They are only a fraction of a normal human life, only a second in the life of a people. And yet the 7 years lying behind us today seem longer than many decades of the past. Within them we feel the concentrated force of historic evolution, the resurrection of a great nation in danger of extinction. This was an eventful, tumultuous period indeed. We were fortunate not only to witness it, but to fashion it in part. At times we nearly lost sight of it. Remember that this is, you know, Germany's at the peak of an economic revival that was unparalleled. After only 7 years, before Hitler rose to power, the German people were usury slaves to the Jews in the Great Depression, just like the rest of the Western world.
The great tragedy for America is that we're in a similar situation, standing on the precipice looking down into the abyss, only we don't have anybody like Hitler wanting to pull us away from there. We just have people that want to push us over the edge.
Well, right, exactly. Today there is much talk about democratic ideals in the outside world, but not in Germany. For here in Germany we had more than enough time, 15 years, to acquaint ourselves with these democratic ideals. He's talking about the Weimar Republic years, right? And we ourselves had to pick up the legacy left behind by this democracy. Democracy, you know, democracy in the early 20th century by the American government, this is the pre-Woodrow Wilson era, was actually seen as a dangerous system of government. And it is. And America was a constitutional republic, right? And it was replaced with the idea of democracy by the Jewish media and popularized in the presidency of Woodrow Wilson, who was the first president that applied the term wrongly to the United States.
So when people talk about American democracy, whether they realize it or not, they're basically talking about Jewish supremacism.
Well, absolutely. that without a doubt that the idea of democracy is a false idea, which breaks down the barriers of the republic set up in its founding documents, and leaves government to the masses. And when government is left to the masses, it's really controlled by the financial oligarchies.
Those who can wield the power of the mob and who organize and direct the mob.
Right, exactly. And when the Jews control 95% of the media, well, guess who that is? Well, when the Jews control the economy, as they came to control our economy in 1913, it was inevitable that they were going to come to control the media.
Absolutely.
Because they have a financial monopoly on printing the money.
Well, they can buy anything they want then.
Today there is much talk about democratic ideals in the outside world, but not in Germany. So here in Germany, we had more than enough time, 15 years, to acquaint ourselves with these democratic ideals. And we ourselves had to pick up the legacy left behind by this democracy. Now we are being credited with many a truly astounding war aim, especially by the English. After all, England is quite experienced in issuing proclamations of objectives in warfare, as it has waged the greatest number of wars the world over. He's very sarcastically taking shots at England throughout this.
Absolutely.
Story, right? Truly astounding.
England is a peaceful power, yet it has the largest empire in the world at the time, and it didn't acquire that by accident.
And it was in war every couple of years with in one part of the world or another.
Does that sound like any country we know today?
Right. And Hitler correctly lays this right at the feet of the Rothschilds and the Sassoons. Truly astounding are the war aims announced to us today. A new Europe will arise. This Europe will be characterized by justice. This justice will render armament obsolete. This will lead to disarmament at last. Of course, he's being tongue-in-cheek, right? This disarmament will in turn bring about an economic blossoming. Change in trade will spring up. Free trade, and with the sponsorship of this trade, culture shall once more blossom, and not only culture will benefit, but religion will also prosper. In other words, we are heading towards a golden age.
Didn't the British already fight the war to end all wars, though?
Well, right, exactly. Well, we have heard of this golden age before. That's Hitler's being sarcastic, right? He's repeating the propaganda of the British bankers.
They must have very short memories in Britain and France.
Well, of course. Very short memory. It's, you know, you tighten up the economy and people forget about politics and that they starve, and then you promise them jobs and money if we go to war, and people are all for it, right? Many times, precisely the same people attempted to illustrate its virtues to us who are now flooding us with descriptions of its benefits. The records are old ones, played once too often. We can only pity these gentlemen who cannot even come up with a new idea to trap a great people. For all this, they had already promised us in 1918. Then, too, England's objectives in the war were the creation of this new Europe, the establishment of a new justice, of which the right to self-determination of the peoples was to form an integral part. Back then already, they promised us justice to render obsolete for all time the bearing of any sort of weaponry. Back then, they already submitted to us a program for disarmament, one for global disarmament. To make this disarmament more evident, it was to be crowned by the establishment of an association of nations bearing no arms.
But the Soviet Union didn't want any part of that.
Yeah, right. That these were to settle their differences in the future, for even back then there was no doubt that differences would still arise. By talking them to death in discussion and debate, just as is the custom in democratic states, there would be no more shooting under any circumstances. In 1918, they declared a blessing and a pious age to come. What came to pass in its stead, we all lived to see. The old states were destroyed, without even as much as asking their citizenry. Historic ancient structures were severed. He's talking about the Habsburgs and the Prussians, right?
Probably the Ottoman Empire.
Right. Not only state bodies, but grown economic structures as well, without anything better to take their place. In total disregard of the principle of the right to self-determination of the peoples, the European peoples were hacked to pieces, torn apart. Great states were dissolved. Nations were robbed of their rights, first rendered utterly defenseless and then subjected to a division which left only victors and a vanquished in this world. And then there was no more talk of disarmament. To the contrary, armament went on, nor did any efforts materialize to settle conflicts peacefully. The armed states waged wars just as before, yet those who had been disarmed were no longer in a position to ward off the aggressions of those well-armed. He's talking about the double crossing of Versailles, right? Naturally, this did not herald economic prosperity, but to the contrary, produced a network of lunatic reparations payments, which led to increasing destitution for not only the vanquished, but also the so-called victors themselves. The consequences of this economic destitution were most acutely felt by the German folk.
Well, they demanded billions from Germany that Germany just didn't have, and the French would not give Germany any sort of forbearance. They wouldn't postpone the payments, so Germany said, fine, you want 5 billion Reichs or 5 billion marks? We'll go print them out, and here you are, 5 billion worthless marks. You asked for it, you got it.
Exactly. And culture, meanwhile, received no support. Instead, it was abandoned to the arbitrary reign of crazed ideas and distortions. Religion, too, had to take a back seat. In these 15 years, not one Englishman recalled the Christian ideals of charity or of love for one's fellow man. The gentlemen went for walks, not with the Bible under their arms, but with the Treaty of Versailles in their hand as their Bible. It contained those 440 articles, all of which represented a burden, an obligation, an indictment, and an extortion of Germany. The League of Nations guaranteed this Versailles. It was not an association of free and equal nations. It was not even a League of Nations. Its founding father refused its recognition from the start. That the U.S. Senate, I believe, wouldn't die.
Absolutely. The Senate would not give up their power to declare war.
Right. It was a so-called League of Nations with the sole intent of guaranteeing this most vile of all diktats. Its mission was to force us to fulfill this diktat.
And I have to wonder, while the British have no love for their German cousins who are starving and being oppressed and suppressed under the burden of Versailles, I'm sure that in Germany's former colonies that the British seized, they're engaging in missionary work to all the Kaffirs, the Hottentots, and the Pacific Islanders, the Samoans, and everybody. Aren't they?
Absolutely. This was the age of democratic Germany. Now that foreign statesmen repeatedly act as though they could not possibly trust present-day Germany, one should remark that this cannot possibly be applied to Germany back then. This former Germany was their own creation, their own work. They should have been able to place trust in it. Yet, instead, just how badly did they treat it? Let us recall the true story of those years, the despondency of the collapse of 1918, the tragedy of the year 1919, all those years of economic decline domestically, the continuation of the enslavement, the ministry of our folk, and above all, the utter hopelessness of those years. Even today, the memory of these years profoundly shakes us. Those were the days when a great nation slowly lost not only its belief in itself, but all hope for justice in this world. During this entire period, democratic Germany hoped in vain, pleaded in vain, and protested in vain. International finance remained brutal and squeezed our folk ruthlessly.
Like Jews would.
Exactly. You cry for relief and they step on your other hand.
They see it as weakness when you ask for help.
Exactly. Worse than prison. The statesmen of the Allied nations closed their hearts to it. In cold blood, they declared that we were 20 million Germans too many. Sounds familiar, right?
Can you imagine that, though, if Ethiopia says that we're in the middle of a record famine, send food? Can you imagine what would happen if the Italian government said, well, you Kaffirs need to stop breeding so much. There's 30 million too many of you.
Well, exactly. And that's the logical outcome, right? Well, right. It's exactly true. It's a very hypocritical world. In those days, it's a world under the rule of Satan, right? In those days, when all hope was for naught, all pleas were in vain, and all protests bore no fruits, in those days when the National Socialist movement came forth from the realization that, in this world, one must...
What was that, Bill?
No. I'm sorry.
I heard you say, in those days when all hope was for naught.
In those days when all hope was for naught, all pleas were in vain and all protests bore no fruits. In those days, the National Socialist movement came forth from the realization that, in this world, one must never stoop to hoping, pleading, or protesting. Instead, in this world, it is imperative, first and foremost, to help oneself.
So Hitler's not a Marxist because Marxists would never teach that.
Well, of course not. Hitler's not a Marxist because Marxism or the way that we perceive socialism today is in handouts and redistribution of wealth, the forced redistribution of wealth. And usually most of it ends up in the pocket of the Jews after it's redistributed. And we see that in the history of Soviet Russia, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Hitler explicitly said in Mein Kampf that National Socialism was not about handouts. It was about giving every man the opportunity to help himself. And Hitler's economic policy reflected that.
And I believe there was probably more social mobility in National Socialist Germany than today in the United States. We have a very rigid class system in this country today.
Well, yes, in a lot of ways we do, except that our universities are geared towards elevating
aliens,
the minorities, the aliens, right?
But I'm saying it's virtually impossible to accumulate capital over a certain number of years because as you're saving money, you're getting wiped out by inflation, you're being taxed to death. So if you save up for 10 years intending to buy a ranch or intending to buy a number of combines and rent them out, or you're intending to start a business and employ a few dozen people, you're always going to be saving, but you're never going to be getting anywhere because your money's becoming increasingly worthless.
Well, right, but it's not the way the nation started out. It's only been that way since 1913, and especially since the late 1950s. Belief in our German folk and the mobilization of its values took the place of hope. We had few real means at our disposal back then. When we regarded as building blocks for our new Reich, besides our willpower, was first our folk's ability to work, second its intelligence, and third what our soil, our Lebensraum, afforded us. And thus we began our work and began Germany's inner uplifting. It did not threaten the world.
It did threaten the Jewish domination of the world.
Yes, it threatened the Jewish domination of the world because Hitler affected Germany's revival free of the Jewish usury system.
Absolutely, and Germany was such an industrialized power and so integral to the domination of Europe that the Jews could not allow an independent Germany because it was basically throwing a monkey wrench into their plans for Europe and the world.
Well, the American people should have realized, and even the people of Britain, what they should have realized was, how could Germany afford to do this? What's different about Germany that they could afford this great economic upsurge while we are starving to death and on food rations because of this so-called depression?
So Germany was a living national spokesman for what a nation could achieve when it shook off the Jews.
And the Jew had to destroy it for that reason. And thus we began our work and began Germany's inner uplifting. It did not threaten the world. It was a work of purely inner domestic reform, and nevertheless, it immediately elicited the hatred of others.
And when he says immediately, he means immediately. March 1933, Judea declares war on Germany, British Daily Express.
As soon as he started printing his own money, right? And threw the Jew bankers out.
Well, how dare a Goyim presume to print his own money? Only the Rothschilds can print money.
These got wind of the renewed rise of the German folk, and it was because we knew of this that we undertook to mobilize Germany's strength. You know it well. In the year 1933, the year we assumed power, I was forced to declare our withdrawal from the League of Nations and from the Disarmament Conference. This forum was incapable of according us justice. In 1934, Germany's rearmament began on a large scale. In 1935, I introduced general conscription. In 1936, I had the Rhineland occupied militarily. It had been demilitarized by World War One.
Right? Well, who are Britain and France to say that German soldiers cannot be in Germany? Imagine, you know, China and Russia telling America, well, you can't have any soldiers in Ohio. That's too close to Canada. And while you're at it, you're going to demilitarize Hawaii and Oregon and Washington. Who are other powers to tell some nation where they can have troops within their own boundaries?
In 1937, the four-year plan was launched. In 1938, the Ostmark and the Sudetenland were integrated into the German Reich. In 1939, we began to establish protection for the Reich against those enemies who had meanwhile cast aside their masks.
And just as an aside, the Ostmark, or the Ostmark, that's Austria. He's referring to the Anschluss.
A mark is a frontier. The steps taken in 1939 served the defense of the Reich. Everything could have developed quite differently had the outside world had as much as an ounce of understanding for the vital concerns of Germany. Often it is said, we should have waited for a negotiated settlement. Remember my Volksgenossen. I did not repeatedly place the colonial question, for instance, before the world to obtain a negotiated settlement. I'm sorry, did I not repeatedly place it? Did we ever receive a response? No. None other than the brusque replies and ever new hateful reactions. The moment the Reich began to reemerge, the leading classes of England and France determined to take up the battle once again. They wanted it thus.
And we should point out that most of the leading classes, especially in England at the time, most of the nobles were either Jews or married to Jewesses.
Yes. Yes, an incredible number of
elite Germans. In Britain at that time. We should basically call it a Jewish elite in England.
Well, right. It's been that way since the late 19th century that most of the English noble families have intermarried with Jews.
If I'm not mistaken, France even had a Jewish president/prime minister, Leon Blum. He served two terms.
Yes, they did, and he was the prime minister of France at this time, and agitating for war the whole time. For over 300 years, England has sought to prevent a real consolidation of Europe, just as France sought to prevent a consolidation of Germany for many a century. Today, Mr. Chamberlain stands up to preach his pious war aims to the outside world. To this, all I can say is, English history has already betrayed your intent, Mr. Chamberlain. For 300 years, your statesmen have spoken just as you do today, Mr. Chamberlain, at the onset of war. They always fought for the Lord and religion. They never had a material goal. He's being sarcastic again. And just because they never fought for such a material goal, the Lord so richly rewarded them in material terms that England always declared itself a fighter for truth and justice and a protagonist of all virtues. This dear Lord has not forgotten. Generously, he has bestowed his blessings on the English. In those nearly 300 years, they have subjugated 40 million square kilometers of soil on this earth. Naturally, they did this not from egotistical motives or because they lusted for mastery, riches, or enjoyment. To the contrary, they were merely fulfilling a mission in the name of the Lord and religion.
So they fought for truth and justice while they herded all those Boer women and children into the camps to die in South Africa.
Well, right, or forced the Chinese to smoke opium, and Hitler's going to get into that here, right?
When they were shipping all the food out of Ireland and leaving the Irish to starve.
Of course, England did not wish to be the sole crusader for the Lord's cause, and thus invited others to partake in this noble exploit. It did not even seek to claim the battle's greatest burdens for itself. In other words, he's making fun of their using other nations to die for them, right?
Well, why should the British die when they can have Indians or Irish or Scots die for them?
Exactly. For ventures so pleasing to the Lord, one can always find others. And England still does this today. And all this is richly rewarding for England. 40 million square kilometers obtained through conquest. A succession of rape, extortion, tyrannical abuse, oppression, pillaging. Events mark English history inconceivable for any other state or for any other people. The English waged war for any old reason. They waged war to expand trade. They waged war to force others to smoke opium. They waged wars for gold mines and for mastery over diamond mines. So there we have the opening of China, and we have the Boer Wars, right? The goals were always material in nature, though hidden beneath a cloak of noble ideals. And this last war was led in the service of noble purposes, too. To have pocketed German colonies in the process was the Lord's will. To have taken our fleet from us, to have pocketed German accounts abroad. All these exploits were mere side effects of the noble struggle for a holy religion. When I see Mr. Chamberlain go about, Bible in hand, preaching his noble war aims, I cannot help having the impression of watching the devil, Bible clasped under his arm, creeping up to a poor soul.
So it seems that the British at this point, their national culture and national identity has been so thoroughly Judaized that they're basically Pharisees and Sadducees.
Well, there's no doubt. It was England has been very hypocritical since the 17th century.
Decent Christian people don't fight a war to force others to smoke opium.
Right, and that was the middle of the 19th century, right? The English Empire may have been expanded with the pretense of good, but it was financed by the Jews of the city, right?
Absolutely, and 90% of the population of South China was addicted to opium. The Chinese government realized that their society was imploding, so they put an end to that, and they said no more opium. The Sassoons in India, Iraqi Jews who moved to India, wouldn't stand for that, so they agitated for war, and there were two opium wars as a result.
And the United States was involved in that, too.
I believe so, yes. I think they did send a fleet to help out, but if the British people were so devoutly Christian, there should have been uprisings in the streets of London when they heard that war was being declared on the Chinese kingdom.
I might be mistaken, but I recall reading that the Forbes family had a hand in the Opium Wars, and a good part of their fortune was extracted from them.
That's possible. I'm not sure of that.
I've read that. I'm fairly certain. I don't know if it's true, but I read it.
I believe the Sassoons today have a media and pharmaceutical empire.
Well, yes, and it's built on the profits of the blood of the common Englishman, without a doubt. All this is no longer original. It is all in exceedingly bad taste. Nobody believes him anymore. Sometimes I fear he is coming to doubt himself. Besides, every folk burns its fingers only once. Only once were the children of Hamelin herded off by the Pied Piper. Only once was the German folk herded off by that apostle of the International Brotherhood of Man, Karl Marx. In this context, I must praise Mr. Churchill. He frankly states what old Mr. Chamberlain only thinks quietly to himself and hopes for secretly. He says, our goal is the dissolution, the destruction of Germany. And that was Churchill's goal, and Churchill made like comments at the end of World War I, right? Our goal is the extermination, if possible, of the German folk. Believe me, I welcome this openness.
And they were pretty open about it. American Jewry especially, they were circulating memorandums, and military studies were commissioned in the mid to late 20s and especially into the early 30s of how to depopulate and destroy Germany.
Well, right. And I don't remember the precise remarks, but at the end of World War I, Churchill is recorded as having made remarks that were very that were very denigrating of Germany, and he made remarks about Britain being able to build a much more magnificent empire without a competition from Germany, basically, right? That's what it was. His remarks proved that World War I was fought for economic purposes and to eliminate competition overseas from Germany. And the French generals also freely discuss what is actually at stake. I believe we can understand each other more easily in this manner. Why always fight with lies and empty phrases? Why not be open about things? We should greatly prefer this. We know the objective they are pursuing, whether or not Mr. Chamberlain walks about with Bible in hand or not, whether he is acting piously or not, whether he speaks the truth or not. We know their goal. It is the Germany of 1648 which they envision, a Germany disintegrated and torn to pieces, which was the aftermath of the 30 Years' War.
Exactly. 20 to 30% of the population of the German states was dead as a result of the 30 Years' War. And
yes.
Interestingly enough, France, a Catholic country, in fact, the so-called defender of the Catholic faith, sided with the Protestants and sent forces into Germany to help the Protestants against the Catholics just to cause further division and death in Germany.
The right, 30%, 50% of the men of Germany perished in the 30 Years' War, 20 to 30% of the overall population, and a third of the villages and towns were destroyed. Also, 30% of the Czech population was destroyed in the 30 Years' War.
Yet here we, at this era now, 38, 39, 40, the Czechs are looking to the French and British to help them out.
Right. But Hitler was well received. I was just sent a whole series of pictures of Adolf Hitler in his reception by the Czechs was actually a very good one, it looked like.
Well, maybe they still had a little bit of a memory of what the British and French had done earlier.
That was 1938, too. And the French generals also freely discuss what is actually at stake. I believe we can understand each other more easily in this manner. Why always fight with lies and empty phrases? Why not be open about things? We should greatly prefer this. We know the objective they are pursuing, whether or not Mr. Chamberlain walks about with Bible in hand or not, whether he is acting piously or not, whether he speaks the truth or not. We know their goal. It is the Germany of 1948 which they envision, a Germany disintegrated and torn to pieces. They know only too well that over 80 million Germans sit in this Central Europe. These human beings have a right to live. They have a right to a piece of the pie, and for 300 years, they were cheated out of it. They could only be cheated since their disintegration led to the weight of their numbers being proportionally undervalued. And thus today, we have 140 men living on one square kilometer. And when such numbers unite, they have power. When they are divided, they are defenseless and impotent. There is a moral imperative lying within the unity also. What does it matter when 30, 50, or 200 small states rise to protest or to claim their vital rights? Who takes note when 80 million men rise up? That is a completely different story. Hence the disinclination against the state-forming activities in Italy, the unity of Germany. They would much prefer to see these states dissolve into their former elements once more.
Not to mention that Italy was dominated by various monarchies out of Spain, out of Austria, and Germany. Some of the German states were dominated by the British. Didn't the British dominate Hanover?
Well, yes, but that was only because it was the house of
the Hanoverians married into the British monarchy.
Right, and Saxe. I'm trying to come up with the name, and I can't.
Saxe-Coburg?
Yeah, right. Saxe-Coburg-Gotha or whatever. The German princes came to be the kings of England. That's why. It's the same thing with James I of Scotland, right? When he became King James V of England, that reunified Scotland and England, but England again became dominant over Scotland. It's the same thing. The German princes became the kings and queens of England, but England came to dominate over Germany for that reason. So it's England has benefited from the royal marriages and the lines of succession and the appointments to the throne. And I'm sure that's been worked out behind the scenes too. I would love to be a fly on a wall when some of those royal houses rose to power in Britain, right?
And they've certainly used Germans as their muscle overseas, you know, when they sent the Hessians and the other German mercenaries to the colonies to try and put down the revolution. Yet they really never did anything for Germany other than hold Germany back from unification.
Well, the Hessians were given to King George, I believe, to settle a debt. I believe that the Prince of Hesse owed him a debt, and that's why the Hessians were employed in that. I might be wrong about that, but I think that's the reason why. They weren't mercenaries. That's a mischaracterization by the British, by the Jewish media, right? And by the English textbook writers,
But now, if I owe somebody a debt, can I send you the work on their farm? Doesn't that violate your rights?
Right. The Hessian soldiers were not mercenaries. They were
unpaid conscripts.
Yes, they were given to the king to settle a debt between the Prince of Hesse and the king. And they themselves didn't have a whole lot of choice in the matter.
And if I recall, I remember reading that after the war, about a third of them stayed in North America. They didn't want to go back to Europe.
Well, from what I understand, during the war, a lot of them defected and blended in with local German populations. Well, Hitler is basically illustrating that the individual German principalities were never a threat to England and France, so nobody ever really cared about them, right? But once they consolidated with Frederick the Great and that then they became a problem because they became a threat. And they were able to project their power overseas and build a navy and start colonies and start bringing their own trade, and England revolted against that. The Jews in London didn't like that idea at all. A few days ago, an Englishman wrote, "So it is indeed the hasty foundation of the German Empire that was not right. Indeed, it was not right. It was not right that 80 million men came together to jointly realize their vital rights. Instead, they would much prefer to see us under 200 or 400 different little flags, or if possible, in some 200 or 300 dynasties. Every dynasty would rule some 100,000 odd men, and these would be silenced, never to be heard of by the rest of the world. Then we as a folk could try to survive as a people of poets and philosophers. Besides this, poets and philosophers also need less food than hard laborers do. This is the problem up for discussion today. Here are great nations which in the course of the centuries were cheated out of their right to life in this world due to their divisions. These nations have now overcome their inner divisions. Today they have entered, as young peoples, the circle of all others who are staking their claim. They are opposed by the so-called owners. These later peoples, who today possess and block large sections of the world without sense of purpose, these who pillaged Germany only a few years ago, these now place themselves in the same position as the so-called possessing classes within a society do. On the world stage, the same thing is repeated which we have already witnessed inside the life of a people. Here, too, there were economic analysis and political opinion to the effect that he who has something has something, he who has nothing has nothing. It was to please the Lord that the one who should possess while the other should not. And it was to remain so for eternity. The new forces have come to oppose this. The one simply cries out, we want only to destroy. We cannot possess. What we cannot possess, we will destroy. This nihilistic force has raged in Germany for a decade and a half. Constructive National Socialism has overcome this force. It has refused to acknowledge the existing state of affairs and undertaken its modification. It changed the method of eradicating the state of affairs by saying, we want to change the state of affairs by gradually permitting the non-possessing classes to partake in the national wealth and by educating them to partake in it. In other words, again, Hitler describes a situation where he is not redistributing people's wealth forcibly, but educating people so that they may earn and keep the fruits of their labors, right? That's National Socialism. Under no circumstances can the man who possesses everything presume himself to possess all-encompassing rights while the other man has no rights. It is no different in the world either. It is not acceptable for 46 million Englishmen to simply block 40 million square kilometers on this earth and to declare, the good Lord gave us this. 20 years ago we got little more yet from you. Now this is in our possession, and we shall not give back any of it. And France, with its truly none too fertile people, numbering hardly 80 men per square kilometer, it has set out to conquer over 9 million square kilometers of soil. Germany, with its 80 million men, possesses barely 600,000 square kilometers.
And a lot of that is due to the fact that Germany lost about, 20% of Germany proper after World War One, and of course it lost all of its overseas possessions.
Well, right, and it had many overseas possessions in Africa and in Asia, and they were all just stripped. When Germany surrendered, when Germany agreed to an armistice in World War One, none of that was on the table.
Absolutely, and we discussed last week, if Germany had known what the Versailles Treaty was going to consist of, there would have been no armistice, and the army never would have left the field.
Well, absolutely. They'd have kept fighting, without a doubt. They had Woodrow Wilson's word. Woodrow Wilson was the only reason why they were forced to consider an armistice was American involvement in a war. France and Britain were as exhausted as Germany was, every bit as exhausted. The Tsar was already beaten by the Jews. They took Russia out of the game. And Germany had a fighting chance in hell without American intervention. The Americans intervened. Woodrow Wilson gave his word. And after the war, he didn't back it up.
Even with American intervention, Germany was hardly beaten. They certainly weren't beaten into a pulp. They weren't beaten into submission. They weren't deserving of a Carthaginian peace, and we were in no position to dictate such a peace to them. I'm sure they were expecting, since they left the field in good fighting order, still, you know, intact as a cohesive army, to receive a decent peace befitting a power such as themselves. They were expecting fair treatment.
Well, of course they were. They had every right to expect it.
And by all historical precedent, Germany hadn't really been conquered. They hadn't been beaten. The war was basically a stalemate.
Right. Germany, with its 80 million men, possesses barely 600,000 square kilometers. This is the problem which must be solved, and it will be solved just as other social questions will be solved. And what we witness today is a larger replay of the same drama we already observed on a smaller stage in the interior when National Socialism launched its struggle for a truly tolerable order and a true community for the benefit of the broad masses of the folk. At the time, liberal and democratic circles, i.e. the possessing classes, and their parties attempted to destroy National Socialism, dissolve the party. The party must be outlawed. This was their eternal battle cry. They saw the movement's dissolution or prohibition as the only means of destroying this force, which they feared might well prove capable of bringing about a change in the existing state of affairs. National Socialism dealt squarely with these other forces. It survived. It inaugurated a new order in Germany, which has persisted in so doing. And today, the possessing part of the world is crying, "We must dissolve Germany. We must atomize these 80 million. They should not be allowed to remain within a congruous state structure, contiguous state structure. Thereby, we can rob them of the force to see their demands through." And these are the objectives England and France are pursuing in this war. Our answer to them, nevertheless, remains the very same one with which we reply to our adversaries internally. "My old party comrades, you know well that the victory of the year 1933 was not a gift. It was the outcome of an unparalleled struggle, which we had to lead for nearly 15 years of a nearly hopeless struggle. You will recall that Providence did not all of a sudden bestow a great movement upon us. A handful of people founded it. They had to laboriously fight to attain their position back then and subsequently to expand upon it. This handful of people then became hundreds, then thousands, then tens and hundreds of thousands, and finally the first million. Then they grew into a second million, later into a third and a fourth million, and thus it was. In the course of a long struggle against thousandfold resistance and assaults, pillage and violation of our rights, that we grew. And we became strong through the struggle, strong internally. And it was thus we struggled for power in these 15 years. We received it not as a gift from the Lord, but as recompense for an unequaled, tough struggle, for courageous persistence in the struggle for power. As I took hold of this power in the year 1933 and took over responsibility, along with the National Socialist Movement, for the future of Germany, I realized that the liberty of our folk must no longer be restricted. I further realized that our struggle had by no means come to an end, but had only begun to be led on a far larger scale. For before us, we had not only the victory of the National Socialist Movement, but the delivery of our German folk. This was our objective. What I have labored for since is but a means to an end. Party, Labor Front, SANSS, all other organizations like the Wehrmacht, the Army, and the Luftwaffe, and the Navy, all these were not ends in themselves, but means to an end. The imperatives of securing the liberty of our folk reigns above all of these.
Would you like me to take over for a bit?
I guess.
Naturally, at home as well as abroad, I have tried to see through the most urgent, inalienable demands by means of negotiations and appeals to reason. I have succeeded in doing so only in a number of cases and instances. In 1938, the realization forced itself upon us that the old war agitators of the World War were beginning once more to get the upper hand in the hostile states. It was then, already, that I began to issue warnings. For what should we think of these states when they first sit down in Munich to conclude an agreement, only then to depart for London to resume agitation, to denounce this agreement as a disgrace, even to insist such a thing would not be repeated a second time. In other words, to declare a voluntary understanding precluded and inconceivable for all times. It was then that the outsiders appeared on the stage in the so-called democracies. I immediately warned of them, for it was perfectly clear the German Volk harbored hatred neither against the English nor the French people. The German Volk desired only to live in peace and friendship with them. The demands we make do not do injury to these peoples. They rob them of nothing. Hence, the German Volk has never been educated to harbor hatred for them. Yet at this point in England, certain circles launched an impertinent, intolerable campaign. To me, this indicated the moment had come to say, we cannot stand by silently any longer. For one day, these agitators in London might well find themselves in government and realize their plans. And then the German Volk will not know what precisely hit it. And thus, I gave orders to enlighten the German Volk regarding this campaign, and from this moment on, I also stood determined to secure the Reich's defenses in one way or another. And interestingly enough, you remember in World War I, the Halt the Hun campaign?
Right.
The Germans are demonized and vilified as Turkic nomads riding in off the steppes. The Germans never returned the favor against the French or British, did they? They never demonized them as a race.
No, never. Well, the French could very well be demonized as a race. That there's one important aspect to all this that a lot of people miss, and that was Germany was the kid that was always getting pushed around. And what people don't understand in human relations is that when you allow yourself to be pushed around, you will always be pushed around. It's only natural that the kid that lets himself be picked on in school is always going to be picked on, is always going to be abused, is always going to be the one whose lunch money is taken. And on a national scale, that also works. And in a group of nations which are relatively equal in might, I mean, France had become a moral basket case by the beginning of World War. Couldn't hold its own, but it was still had a pretty large army and was well armed.
On paper.
Well, right. And we have Britain, France, and Germany, and even if you want to count Russia, in a nation of equal, in a world with nations of equal might and ability, if you are the one that lets yourself be kicked around all the time, there's no end to it. Where does it end?
But the day Germany finally said, we're not giving you our lunch money, all the bullies shouted that Germany was an aggressive bully.
And Germany had to die, right. Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
In 1939, the Western powers finally dropped their masks. Despite all our attempts and our advances, they sent us their declaration of war. And today they freely admit, indeed, Poland may well have given way, but we did not want it to. Today they admit it would have been possible to arrive at an understanding, but they wanted war. This was precisely what my domestic opponents used to tell me. I held out my hand in friendship to them, but they also refused it, and they also cried, no reconciliation, no understanding, only war. Well, they got their war, and I can only say to France and England, you too shall have your war. The first phase in this war consisted of political action. It freed our rear first of all. For years, Germany collaborated with Italy in policy formation, This policy has not changed to this day. The two states are close friends. There is a common denominator to their interests. In the past year, I have tried to rob England of the means to allow the conflict it envisioned to escalate into a general world war. The pious Mr. Chamberlain, who studies, reads, and preaches the Bible, labored for months to arrive at an understanding with the atheist Stalin. He attempted to conclude a pact with him. In this, he failed at the time. Now, that speaks volumes that Chamberlain would go to Soviet Russia and try and rub elbows with somebody such as Stalin.
Well, right, but I believe that he was told to go to Soviet Russia, and he'd better rub elbows with Stalin, right?
Absolutely. I understand that England is raging now, that I have done what Mr. Chamberlain in vain sought to do, and I also comprehend that what was pleasing to the Lord in Mr. Chamberlain's case should be far less pleasing to the Lord in my case. But nevertheless, I do believe the Lord Almighty to be well pleased that a senseless war on so vast a terrain was prevented. So the British are denouncing Germany, a Christian country, for making a pact of understanding with an atheist communist power, but the English themselves have been trying that very same pact.
Yes. Yes, and Stalin made the pact with Germany.
But I think that Stalin intended to violate it sometime in mid to late 41. Hitler just, you know, beat him. He had to preempt him.
Well, you know, I get the feeling that, and I haven't searched all of this out, but I get the feeling that Germany needed the pact, the non-aggression pact with Stalin, because Germany was still in a state of weakness, and Adolf Hitler knew it. And we've demonstrated that when Operation Barbarossa had to be launched, Germany was at a severe disadvantage in terms of men and weaponry, right?
They were outnumbered, I think, 4-1 by men, 10-1 in tanks. The Soviets had 3 times as many aircraft.
Well, right. So I really believe that Germany, it was a coup for Germany because it would give Germany hoped it would give them the time to build up where she could face Russia. But
Stalin knew how weak Russia was. And I think that, you know...
Well, Germany didn't, though. I don't think Germany really did. And I think that Hitler thought that Russia was a much larger threat at a much sooner time. However, the benefit of the non-aggression pact with Germany for Stalin was that he got to invade Finland and the Baltic states and demand parts of Romania and not have a worry about repercussions from Germany.
I believe if the Winter War in Finland had gone very well for the Soviets, they would have invaded Germany in 1940.
Well, that's a very good possibility.
But they got clobbered by the Finns, even though they outnumbered the Finns 8-1 in most instances.
Yes, they had some setbacks, and they had to settle for a negotiated peace with Finland. And Finland made some cessions.
I believe they seceded Karelia and a few other areas.
Yeah, they handed over to Russia some regions along the Baltic and part of the southern peninsula. But aside from that, Finland survived the war through her bravery, and that shook up Russia, I believe.
Finns are definitely better soldiers than the Soviets.
Well, you know, patriots who are defending their homeland are always going to be better soldiers than conscripts who have been sent far away and forced to do something they really don't want to do.
Stalin killed most of the career officers and replaced them with political hacks.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did that in the purges.
So when he did that in 36, he needed several years for those people to acclimate and get adjusted to their positions. Throughout centuries, Germany and Russia have lived next to each other in peace and friendship. Why should this not be possible in the future once again? Well, of course, you know, he's posing that rhetorically, but we know the answer that a Russia in the hands of white Christian people, of course you can live peacefully next to it, but a Russia that's now a Soviet Union in the hands of Bolshevik Jews, peace won't be possible.
Well, exactly.
I believe it to be possible since both peoples so desire. Any attempt on the part of the British and French plutocracies to raise renewed controversy between us will fail as we realize their true intentions. And thus today, Germany does not have to worry about its rear politically. The second task of the year 1939 was to secure this rear militarily as well. The strength of our Wehrmacht trampled to the ground the hope of the English military experts that under no circumstances could the war against Poland be decided in less than 6 months or a year. The state to which England had extended its guarantee was swept from the map within 18 days. Hence, the first phase of this war has come to an end, and the second one begins. That must have sent shockwaves throughout Britain, since the British had been saying that the German military was worthless and that Poland would crush them.
Well, and after that, and after the disaster at Dunkirk, England wanted no part of Germany. England knew, even Churchill knew, that he was never going to beat Germany without American intervention.
That's why
they never launched it after Dunkirk. England never launched another invasion.
Absolutely. Mr. Churchill is already dying to start it. He cherishes the hope, as expressed by intermediaries as well as by his own person, that bombardment should finally, and as soon as possible, feature in this war. And already they are crying that this war should not pay heed to women and children. For when has England ever paid heed to women and children? After all, this entire blockade warfare is nothing other than a war against women and children, just as once was the case in the Boer War.
Right, and England invented the concentration camp in the Boer War and loaded it with Dutch women and children.
Absolutely. It was then that concentration camps were invented. The English brain gave birth to this idea. We only read about it in the encyclopedias, and we later copied it, with one crucial difference. England locked up women and children in these camps. Over 20,000 Boer women died wretchedly at the time. Why should England fight differently today? We have anticipated this, and we have prepared ourselves.
Now let me say that, at the end of World War II, thousands and thousands of women and children were liberated from German concentration camps, where they were kept. The children of Jewish communists and Jewish rabble-rousers and Jewish partisans and Jewish criminals and others, and the women were all... I have many pictures from the New York Times and from other sources that show very healthy-looking women and children coming out of those, being liberated from those concentration camps in 1945. The Jewish women and children that were arrested and kept in concentration camps were well taken care of, opposed to the South African women and children.
They all died.
Yeah, right. They were abused and starved to death.
People may not think 20 or 30,000 dying is a whole lot, but keep in mind that was about one-fifth of the entire Boer community.
Yes, it was a huge percentage of the population at that time.
And the Boers have never recovered.
And the English, playing the whore for the Jew, destroyed South Africa just like they destroyed Germany.
I mean, Mr. Churchill, rest assured that we do know what has happened in England within these 5 months, and in France, too. However, he apparently does not know what has happened in Germany within these 5 months. Evidently, these gentlemen are of the conviction that we slept through those past 5 months. Since the day I stepped onto the political stage, I have never yet slept through a single day of importance, not to speak of 5 months. I can assure the German Volk of one thing. In these 5 months, we have scored enormous achievements. What was built within Germany in the previous 7 years pales in comparison to the attainments of these 5 months. Our armament program was launched according to plan. The plan proved its worth. Our foresight is just now beginning to bear fruits. These fruits are of such an impressive nature that our adversaries are beginning to imitate us. Alas, they are poor imitators. Naturally, the English broadcast service is no better. According to them, the skies above England are so darkened by British squadrons flying overhead that the sun can no longer shine there today. The world is one immense arsenal, equipped by England, working for England, supplying the massive British armies. Germany is standing on the brink of a total breakdown. I just heard today that we possess only 3 more U-boats. This is truly disastrous, not for us, however, but for English propaganda. Since should these 3 items be destroyed, and this could be as early as today or tomorrow, what will be left to be destroyed? The English will be forced to sink U-boats preemptively, which we are to build only in the future. And then somehow, they will have to come to terms with a method of resurrecting U-boats. Undoubtedly, English ships will continue to be sunk as we possess no more U-boats. The U-boats attacking them will have to be U-boats which the English have previously sunk. Further, I read that I have succumbed to deep despair and sadness, as I had expected us to build 2 U-boats every day while we were turning out only 2 every week. To this, I can only say it is not good to have one's war reports, and especially one's radio broadcasts, authored by members of a people which has not fought for several thousands of years. For after all, the last documented battle involving the Maccabees is slowly losing its instructive value for military history. When I turn to look at this foreign propaganda, my belief in our victory grows to the immeasurable. For this propaganda I experienced once before. For nearly 15 years this propaganda was directed against us. My old party comrades, you remember this propaganda. There are the same words, the same phrases. Yes, when we look more closely, we see the same heads speaking the same dialects. I finished off these people as a lonely, unknown man who gathered but a handful of people about him. Throughout 15 years, I finished off these people. And today, Germany is the greatest world power. It is not as though age, as such, results in wisdom. No more are the blind restored to sight by old age. Whoever was afflicted with blindness before remains so today. Whoever is afflicted with blindness will be cursed by the gods. Today, the German Wehrmacht, the best of its kind, is fencing off these forces. Above all, the German Volk is fencing off these forces with its insight and its discipline. For 7 years, National Socialist work has educated it in all areas. That this is not just a fantasy is something you can see today. This education has overcome differences of classes and ranks. It has eliminated parties, eradicated different Weltanschauung, and has placed the community in its stead. Today, the soul of this community is suffused with a singular, glowing trust and a fanatical will. This time, this community will not make the mistake of 1918, when today, Monsieur Daladier expresses doubts regarding this community, or when he believes that parts of this community are lamenting their lot, or when he is quoting my own homeland. Oh, Monsieur Daladier, you shall yet get to know my men of the Ostmark. They shall personally instruct you. You shall get to know their divisions and regiments, just as well as the other German ones. Perhaps then you shall be cured of a peculiar form of insanity, namely the insanity of believing you are faced by the German tribes of old. Monsieur Daladier, you are faced by the entire German Volk today, and it is the National Socialist German Volk. This Volk, for which National Socialism has so struggled, and which, through laborious works, has received its present-day education, it is immune to these international delusions. And this, in fact, represents a permanent cure. The National Socialist Party guarantees this. Would you like to take over for a bit, Bill?
And the hopes they entertain to drive a wedge between folk and party, or party and state, or party and Wehrmacht, or party and me, are childishly naive. 15 years ago, my adversaries clung to exactly the same hopes. As a National Socialist, I have known nothing other than work, struggle, worries, labors. I believe Providence has destined our generation for nothing else. Once, 25 years ago, the German folk set out to fight a war forced upon it. The folk was not well armed. France applied the power of its people in a fashion quite differently from Germany of the time. Russia was the mightiest adversary. The whole world was successfully mobilized against this Germany. Thus, the folk set out to do battle and wrought many a wondrous but heroic deed. And Providence was with our folk. Hitler was a Christian, there's no doubt. The year 1914 delivered our homeland from the threat of foreign break-ins. The year 1915 improved the situation of the Reich further still. 1916, 1917, year after year, battle after battle. At times, everything seemed on the verge of collapse when, as though by miracle, the Reich was rescued. Germany then afforded us with truly astounding proofs of its internal strength. Obviously, Providence had blessed it. Then the German folk became ungrateful. Then it began to listen to the promises of others, instead of looking trustingly to its own strength and hence to its own future. And finally, in its ungratefulness, the German folk turned against its own Reich, its own leadership, and then it was that Providence turned away from the German folk. Since then, I have come to regard this catastrophe as something not wholly undeserved. If I have never complained that Providence had somehow wronged us, or I had never complained that Providence had somehow wronged us. On the contrary, I always supported this thesis. Providence only gave to us what we deserved in the end. The German nation was ungrateful, therefore it was deprived of its recompense. This will not happen a second time in our history. The National Socialist movement has already passed through a trial period. The 15 years of struggles were not only days of glory, of marvelous victories. They were a time of many a worry. At times, our enemies were already jubilantly hailing our destruction. Yet the movement held its own with a heart filled with strength and joy. Time and time again, trusting in the necessity of our struggle, it leapt up once more to face the enemy and to carry the victory in the end. This is the task of the German nation today. 80 million men are stepping up to the line now, as many enemies are standing across from them. These, our 80 million today, enjoy an excellent internal organization, the best possible, in fact. They have a strong faith. Their leadership is not bad. Rather, as I am convinced, it is the best. Führer and Folk today realize that no understanding is possible if we do not insist upon our rights. We do not wish the struggle for these rights to burst forth anew into 2, perhaps 3 or 5 years. The rights of 80 million are up for discussion, not those of a party or of a movement, for who am I? I am nothing other than your speaker, German Folk, the speaker for your rights. The Folk has vested its trust in me. I will prove myself worthy of this trust. I wish to draw attention not to my own person and my surroundings, but rather to the past and to the future. I wish to stand in honor before the great, before the past and the future, and with me, the German Folk shall honorably hold its own. The generation of today, it is the bearer of Germany's destiny, of Germany's future, or Germany's fall. Our enemies, they already cry out today, Germany shall fall. Yet Germany can give but one answer. Germany will live, and hence Germany will win. At the beginning of the 8th year of the National Socialist Revolution, our hearts turn to our German Folk and its future. We want to serve this future. We want to fight for it, and if necessary, to fall for it. We will never capitulate for Germany. Germany must win, and it will win. And it's a shame that it didn't win. But such is history. That's the end of Adolf Hitler's speech in the Sportpalast on January 30th, 1940, which was obviously the 7th anniversary of the rise to power of the National Socialist Party.
Of course, the French were claiming that the German army would commit suicide on the Maginot Line, but that, of course, didn't happen.
Well, what we've seen is we've seen that many German generals sold Germany out.
Mm-hmm. But just as Poland was wiped off the map in 18 days, France lasted about, what, a week longer than Poland?
Yeah, maybe 4 or 5 weeks, 6 weeks, I forget exactly, but it wasn't long.
I think it was, what, May 10th, 1940 to June 22nd, 1940, something like that?
Yes, it wasn't very long at all.
And that's what happens to those degenerate powers, degenerate Judaized Poland and degenerate mongrel France. They couldn't hold their own against a unified white nation, Germany.
Well, right, and if the basically, if Woodrow Wilson and the United States Senate in 1913 didn't sell the country out to the Jews wouldn't have been able to take over the world. 1913 is the date of the fall of Western civilization.
All right. Do you have any final thoughts, Bill?
Well, no. I mean, how could I top Adolf Hitler? He had a lot of trust. He was a good Christian man who had trust in God and trust in his people. There's nothing else I could add to that.
Of course, in the movies, America's the good guy and we always win, but look at who the movies are made by. The movies are made by bad guys.
Well, of course. The movies are made by the Jews.
So in history, the bad guys usually win, but we know in the final chapter, the good guys win.
At the end, we shall win, and Germany will rise again, no doubt. And the South. The South will rise again, too. But the Jew won't be found.
Thank you. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh.